Welcome to another episode of the Track and Food Podcast. You are joining us again today. I'm your host, as always, Jamie Ma. To my left, as always, is our co-host, Mick.
Yo.
And we brought on another guest today. His name is Sean McGuigan. He's the current bar manager for the Lobby Lounge at the Fairmont Pacific Rim. Hey, Sean, how are you?
Hey, guys. Very well. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for coming on, man. Appreciate it.
So we've decided to bring on another Fairmont bartender, probably and most specifically because the Fairmont at this current time is going through kind of a little awakening.
It's so hot right now.
No, they're very hot right now.
So hot. On fire.
One of the main reasons why we wanted to bring Sean on today is he was also one of the bartenders to compete with Chris, and we wanted to get his experience as well. For anyone who doesn't know, Chris Enns was the winner of the Diageo Canada, but Sean also placed in the top five. How is this experience for you? Is this the first time you've competed for Diageo?
So this is actually the second time I've gone through the Diageo World Class process. It's an amazing competition. It's the most comprehensive competition in the entire bartending world. There are many comps out there with different brands, and usually they'll have you make one or two cocktails with one spirit. What really sets Diageo apart is that they have an entire spirits portfolio to work with. They work with brands like Ketel One, Tanqueray No. 10, Don Julio, the entire range, Bullet, Ronza Capa, and then an entire host of single malt whiskeys such as Talisker, such as Oban, Lagavulin, and they also represent the Johnny Walker range. So you really have this entire palette of different spirits that you have to work with, and so you really have to have a comprehensive knowledge of all of those different spirit categories and what flavors really work well with those different ingredients. And then they really challenge you to come up with cocktails in a way that you wouldn't come up with them organically. So first challenge we had to do is called the single ingredient challenge. So you take an ingredient that's locally produced, that has a special significance to you and to Canada, and then take that ingredient and apply it in as many different ways as you can to five classic cocktails that they specified. So the Moscow Mule, the Martini, the Manhattan, the Margarita, and the Daiquiri. So for my single ingredient challenge, I picked rhubarb.
Why rhubarb?
Rhubarb, so for me, you know, the brief was to come up with an ingredient that had some special significance for you and was locally produced and significant to Canada. So when I thought significant to Canada, that reminded me of Canada Day. And when I was a kid growing up, you know, we would always have these Canada Day block parties where the whole neighborhood would come out, sort of like a potluck, and everybody would bring, you know, home-cooked ingredients. And my mom would always bring rhubarb pie.
My favorite. Exactly, my favorite when I was a kid. A little bit of vanilla ice cream on there.
Yes, sir.
Did she make it with strawberry or just rhubarb?
So there was a rhubarb pie, but then there was also a strawberry rhubarb shortcake.
Oh,
so
sweet. Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah. So I took that and riffed this into this whole sort of like home cooked, you know, down home kind of picnic vibe. And for the Moscow Mule, I house fermented a rhubarb ginger beer, just using some champagne yeast and some saison brewer's yeast. For the dry martini, I did a rhubarb bitters. But like a really sort of citrusy and bright rhubarb bitters. For the Manhattan, I made a rhubarb Amaro. There's a product you can get it in the United States. It's called Zucca, Rabarbaro. So this is an Italian Amaro, a bittersweet herbal digestif. And the main base of this ingredient is Chinese rhubarb, dried Chinese rhubarb root.
Okay.
So I went to Chinatown, you know, went to these little Chinese apothecary stores. And you have to have the Chinese translation on your phone so you can show them. Otherwise,
you're not going to look.
No, you'll walk in and you'll be like, hi.
Like, fuck off.
They'll give you the look like, what are you doing here? And you walk up to the desk and you say, hey, do you have rhubarb? And then we'll go, rhubarb? No, we don't have that. And then you'll show them the Chinese characters on your phone and they'll be like, oh, that. And then they'll get it for you.
Which place did you go to, by the way?
So it's on the corner of Columbia and Pender. I forget what the store is called.
I've heard there's like a lot of these.
Yeah, there's a lot of them.
There's a few places of them. The best one that I've been to is the one that's kind of right in the heart of Chinatown. So Pender and Columbia, it's on the northwest corner.
Upstairs, and downstairs?
Downstairs, just ground level. There's two entrances. It's right on the corner.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, it's a gold mine. You really have to know what you're looking for going into it. So knowing that, you know, Chinese rhubarb, dried Chinese rhubarb root was something that, you know, I could probably find there. You know, I went in there with a little bit of confidence as opposed to going in there and being like, oh, well, whatever that is. But so she brings down this massive jar of this, you know, dried brown, kind of chalky, dusty looking root, opens it up, and it smelled exactly like the Amaro that I'm sort of basing this off. And I thought this was going to be crazy expensive. You know, I'm going to walk out of here with a $40 bill. I just asked for, you know, two big handfuls, and the bill came to like $4. So if you ever want, you know, crazy Amaro or bitter ingredients, you know, go to Chinatown.
If you want anything,
it's a steal.
I live in Chinatown, and there's a grocery store right across the street from Mammy Taylor's that I always go to.
Yeah.
And literally, I can walk in there and get a full bag of groceries. I'm talking like five avocados, carrots, you know, a cucumber, tomatoes, greens. And the lady will ring it up. She's like, $8. Yeah. And I'm just like, why would you shop anywhere else? It's like, yeah. I'm like, I love Chinatown.
The rest of us are getting taken for a ride.
It's 40 at Whole Foods, yeah. And it's organic. Yeah, you can't see because it's a podcast, but I'm holding up my air quotes.
Air quotes, organic. Yeah, yeah. But if you go to, you know, Whole Foods or Urban Fare and you go for, say, like green cardamom pods, like, and you get this tiny little tin, you know, again, I'm using my hands to gesture, but like a 2-inch by 2-inch tin of cardamom pods, and it rings you up for like $10. You can get a bag of cardamom for 35 cents in Chinatown.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
if you're ever looking for cool botanicals to, you know, make into bitters or anything like that.
So it looks like this experience for you preparing for it is a big process.
Well, yeah, it sounds like you made something specific for every drink.
That is true. Every drink you do have something
prepared. And that's just for the
first... We sort of got off on a little tangent on the Amaro, but there was also pickled rhubarb. There was some rhubarb shrub that went in the margarita, and then the base for the Amaro then got used as bitters. And that was just one of the challenges. There was two other challenges where we had to make our own ingredients. And yeah, so that's
time consuming.
It's really time consuming. And you know, the first thing you want to do when you're setting out to do these competitions is pick interesting flavors, make sure that they work with all the products, and then actually go ahead and make these ingredients. And you don't want to make them too far in advance, because then you'll have to make them again, because not all of them are shelf stable.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you could have variation batch to batch. So you are kind of confined to making these ingredients in sort of like the 2-week run up to your presentation. This is also when you should be practicing your presentations, because when you get on stage, you know, if you haven't practiced and you are sort of trying to run to a script, the first thing you're going to do is just totally blank and forget what you're going to say. And that anxiety around not sticking to something that you've prepared can kind of cripple you for the rest of your set. So we had a speed round this year in the regional finals, which thankfully, after lots of practice, I absolutely crushed it.
Like, oh, nice.
Yeah. So got all my drinks up and, you know, garnishing them, throwing the garnish at the drink with like seconds to go, put my hands up, you know, right as time was called. Totally nailed it.
Oh, is this the one you're talking about, the botanist?
This was the one that happened in the botanist.
Botanist, yeah, I saw that. Yeah. That was awesome. He literally puts his hands up, and everyone's just like, ah!
Time. Yeah, buzzer beater.
Yeah, it was awesome.
Yeah, it was a buzzer beater. You know, Jamie's would know about buzzer beaters. Yeah,
he pulled a LeBron James.
There you go. If we can tie this into basketball, it's going to be Jamie's.
We always
day.
Find a way to tie it into basketball.
Yeah.
But, so you're like pretty new into the competition scene then?
No, actually. So this would probably be... Oh boy, probably about the 30th competition that
I've
been doing.
Okay.
I've been doing competitions since really the beginning of my cocktail bartending career. When I was at the Clue Club, which was really the first cocktail bartending job that I had back in 2013. Yeah.
Is that the first bartending job you got? Or?
Well, no, actually. So I started in the industry at Steamworks Brew Pub in Gastown.
Oh, no shit. I used to work there too.
Really?
Yeah, 2003. Downstairs.
2003? Downstairs?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I started.
For a brief moment in time, like
it's a
4 months.
No,
Jamie. But that's when they used to make good beer.
Come on. I mean, it's you know, it's like the guy in the friend group that's the asshole, and you say he's our asshole. It's our shithole.
It's our shithole.
I love
the beer
that
used
place.
To be really, really good.
I get the place.
When they were brewing it on location there,
that was really good. Conrad Moser, now of Brass Neck Brewery, was running the show.
Exactly.
He's not anymore.
Their seasonal beers were unbelievable.
Yeah.
I think they had a cherry Christmas ale. Yeah, but they moved their operation to Burnaby, and
well, they're,
production's
they're
gone
commercializing.
Up.
You know, it's a bit different.
Yeah,
but yeah, what they're Conrad really did there, and
was he the original brewmaster?
He was. Yeah, he was there for 15 years. It was interesting because he started at Steamworks in 1994 or 1995, and it was funny because when I was working with him in 2009, and when I was, you know, 20. And I said, oh, when did you start? And he said, oh, in 1995. Oh, great. When I was in kindergarten. So he'd been there from my kindergarten to my, you know, being 21. And that was my sort of introduction to the service industry. Started as a busser and then sort of worked my way up through expediter and server and then barback and then bartender. And throughout that process of moving my way up into the bar and trying to learn as much as I could about spirits and cocktails and beer, it really became an obsession, at which point I was coming to learn a lot about cocktails. And it became very clear very quickly that Steamworks wasn't the environment to nurture that newfound passion. And so I got a job at the Clue Club. And
was that right when they opened?
No. That was about a year after they opened.
Okay.
The Clue Club opened with Joey Donnelly and Sam. I'm forgetting his last name. French Sammy. Great guy. Anyhow, those two had both moved on by the time I got to the Clue Club. And within about 3 months of starting at the Clue Club, Jay Jones came in to take over the management of the Clue Club. And he was really the guy that got me into cocktail competitions.
Legendary Jay Jones, by the way, the man who kind of was one of the pioneer bartenders here in the Vancouver bartending scene.
Absolutely.
He's known. He's basically the guy who built and designed the Boarhouse. That's basically his bar.
He's one of the OGs.
Yeah.
He was one of my first bar mentors as far as
great mentor,
cocktails go. Great mentor. And one day I walked into work and he was playing that song from, I'm forgetting the show, but it's sort of that surf rock, like the epitome of surf rock song with that like heavy bass line. I think it's called Pipeline. You know that song? It kind of has that like
is it called Pipeline?
I think it's called, there's a song called Pipeline. Anyway, he was playing that song and he said, "Hey Sean, what do you think of this song?" I said, "Oh yeah, this is like that surf rock song." He said, "Okay, make me a cocktail for this." And I forget what I put in it, but it was rummy and it was tiki and it was a summery surfer cocktail. And he was like, "Wow, this is great. Have you ever thought about doing cocktail competitions?" So this was my like little interview for him for cocktail competitions. And I said, "No, I'd never done them, but you know, sure, I'd be open to it. When do you want me to do it?" "How's tomorrow?"
Oh, shit.
So this is like mid-service on a Saturday night. And I go, "Oh, well, okay, I think I can try and throw something together for this. Do you have any tips?" And he said, "Well, I'm judging it, so I can't give you any tips."
I see.
So he said, "You know, make a twist on a mint julep. So it's got to be bourbon, it's got to be mint, and then the rest is up to you. So go nuts." And then over the next couple hours, I sort of scrounged around the bar. I was thinking mint, well, that goes well with chocolate. Chocolate has this, you know, really a dark chocolate has this great like smoky flavor that reminded me of mezcal. So then it became like this like chocolate mint mezcal bourbon julep. It was an interesting coincidence because the mint julep being the official drink of the Kentucky Derby. Mm-hmm. The year previous to that, the guy that won the Kentucky Derby was a guy named, I think his name is Mario Gutierrez. He had his start racing at Hastings Park in Vancouver.
No,
so
no shit.
A Mexican jockey who grew up on the Vancouver horse racing scene, you know, at the location where this competition was being held, the synergy between those themes was just right there. So the Gutierrez cocktail, a mezcal chocolate twist on the julep.
Did you win?
I won the competition.
You won the fucking competition.
I won that
competition.
Holy
shit.
Yeah.
First time.
I'm like listening to the story and I'm like watching him talk and I'm like, the motherfucker won this thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that was like my first foray into the competition. I didn't even know what to expect. I'd never even seen one. I didn't even know these things really existed.
Instinctually, without knowing too much of what goes on, tied all these things in together in a nice, neat little package.
Yeah, the night before.
Fucking nice work, buddy.
Yeah, it was a good experience to get my feet wet. And that was a great competition. And like, there were some heavy hitters competing. Like, I competed against my current boss, Grant Sini, who is the Diageo World Class 2014 Canadian champion. And so I beat him, which is it's a feat I've never repeated, but you know.
I mean, anytime you can beat Grant Sini, you got to rub that in.
Man, yeah. Beating Grant Sini.
Shout out to Grant.
That was one of the early highlights of my career. I still cherish that memory.
Guys
like Alex Black and Robin Gray, Evelyn Schick was competing in that competition. So there was some
this
serious.
This is nobody comes in and just like swoops in and just like.
Seriously.
Or Wonderchild.
Yeah. Yeah, take note.
You got the Prodigy over here. Maybe this LeBron James reference is something that should stick.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah.
How many game winners you got in you, buddy?
Well, I mean, it was actually interesting because after that first competition, I ended up going to win a Calvados competition at UVA, which is the second competition that I did. And then after that, it was a long drought. And that really, I felt kind of jaded for a little while after winning the first two and then really just dropping the ball on the subsequent competitions, Beefeaters, the first time I did Beefeater, the first time I did Diplomatico. But I think that really sort of taught me a lot about ways to effectively approach competitions. You really have to read the rules very explicitly. You have to know a lot about the brands. You have to tie in the brands. You have to practice a lot.
Yeah.
And really, quite critically, quite importantly, you can't go in with the expectation that you're going to win. You really have to take these as, you know, great experiences, even not winning, and, you know, take whatever lessons you can out of that and use them as networking opportunities. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, some of the best experiences I have traveling and competing with different brands, you know, were for competitions that I ultimately didn't win. So the two big ones over the last couple of years that I did that, you know, I was able to win or succeed at the local level and then go to the next stage and then not go any further, but the trips were amazing, was for firstly for Bacardi, Bacardi Legacy competition last year, and then the Diplomatico Global Cocktail competition last year as well. So with Bacardi,
yeah, you went to Venezuela, right?
Well, with Bacardi, I went to Miami and to Puerto Rico. In the regional finals, I was the wild card, so I was a runner up actually to Chris Entz, who we work with at the Fairmont Pacific
Chris
Rim.
Chris
Mother Friendly Entz, who is currently so hot right now.
My boy's on fire.
Yeah, so he won in Montreal. He's our Canadian champ. He's going to Berlin in October. So I couldn't be more excited about that.
So without knowing all that backstory on, we were thinking it was the podcast bump, the track and food bump.
Yeah,
that exactly. Gave him the win. But now I know that's totally not true.
Yeah. Well, the episode did come out 3 hours before he won.
That's true. So. Ooh, serendipitous timing on that one. It was my fault, actually. I'm the one who put out the podcast, and like it had skipped my mind that he was competing that weekend. So I actually messaged him. I was like, "Hey, man, podcast coming up," like probably that afternoon. And he's like so swamped with like prep and like getting organized. And I'm like blowing up his like phone, like, "Hey, podcast up, take a listen." He's like, "Hey, yeah. Thanks, man. Yeah."
Well, yeah, that sounds like Chris. You know, even under
right
pressure,
away.
He's like super enthusiastic.
Absolutely,
I can tell you that night I was a fiend packing and like double checking everything. It took me hours to pack my suitcase. Man.
Why?
Oh, well, because you got to bubble wrap like literally everything.
I heard you took a nice little manufactured octopus. Is this?
Yes. So one of the props that I brought was a little foam, paper mache, paint and wood octopus model. It's funny, you know, all the skills you need to succeed in these competitions, you know, knowledge about products, obviously bartending skills, the ability to balance a drink, presentation skills. You got to get crafty sometimes. And you look around the prep room in World Class, and everybody, like down to a person, had at least one crafted little diorama tablescape thing. Like, so with Chris, he had this this wooden box with these sort of moss-covered stones and flowers that was the presentation piece for his cocktail that represented somewhere he traveled to. So it was Japan. He called it the Hanami Highball. Mm-hmm. Sean Sewell from Victoria, his travel-inspired cocktail was for Iceland. And so it was this lake bed made out of lava rocks with like a resin glaze that looked like water. And he put his drink on that. So everybody gets pretty crafty. I mean,
cool.
Yeah. And, you know, house made, you know, bartender made graphic design as well.
yeah, exactly.
It's pretty cool. So with Bacardi, they took us to their distillery in Puerto Rico, just as like an educational trip.
Isn't Bacardi originally from Cuba?
So yes. So Bacardi originally from Cuba.
Okay.
And up until recently, they've really sort of
Fidel Castro.
They've hammered that into their brand, you know, like Bacardi founded in Cuba. And it was founded in Cuba. I mean, it was the original Cuban rum, like when the daiquiri was created, when the mojito was created in the 30s. Yeah, exactly. So when those were created in the 1930s in Cuba, Bacardi was the rum that they were pouring.
So when did they move to Puerto Rico?
So Bacardi actually, the reason why Bacardi survived and is thriving and alive is that before the revolution happened, they had already expanded to Puerto Rico. Their operation had expanded. They were such a big company, so successful. Really, because in the 1930s during Prohibition, you know, if you wanted to drink and you were a wealthy Manhattanite, you know, you jumped on a plane, you went to Cuba and you drank your face off for 7 days, and Bacardi was what you were drinking. So Bacardi was raking it in. And so they set up other production facilities in Mexico, and then their main distillery, they moved it to Puerto Rico before the revolution even happened.
And that they got lucky because of that, because if they hadn't done that, when Fidel Castro and the revolution happened, they seized everything.
Yeah.
And they luckily moved over, I think, their recipes and everything.
Yeah, it could be dismantled.
So they weren't able to take that. So they got lucky.
Wow.
Like, very lucky. But
going to Puerto Rico, which is, you know, has been their main facility since prior to the revolution, it's incredible. It's a massive, massive production facility. And I think a lot of people associate these massive rum companies with, like, not having, I don't know, a whole lot of heart or a whole lot of soul. And I can tell you that's just not true. I went there and we had the opportunity to hang out with the master distiller who has his PhD from MIT in microbiology
really?
And chemical sciences. And he is like a wunderkind. He's, you know, he's in his late 30s, but, you know, he's still a young guy. And
he's their master distiller?
Yeah. And just listening to this guy talk about, you know, the processes and, you know, the way the yeast interacts and, you know, which distillation systems they're using for different products. And yeah, he really sort of opened my eyes to the fact that, you know, while this is this massive industrialized computerized process, like, you know, there's still a lot of love that goes into this. And then, you know, even more to that, once you get into, you know, blending, you know, it's no longer really about science. It's more about art. And the master blender, who is this tiny little old guy with like bottle cap glasses and like this like amazing passion for rum. So we went into the aging warehouse for Bacardi, and this thing is like a football field size, and it's one of dozens of aging warehouses they have, where there's literally millions of barrels of rum aging, and most of the stuff goes into the Bacardi 8, the Ocho.
Yeah,
which
I love. I think Bacardi, it's fantastic.
I think it's a fabulous rum. It's definitely underrated. I can tell you it's underpriced. They definitely price it below what they know they could charge for it. And just being in this warehouse, man, like the smell of evaporated rum is so thick that, like, you know, you walk in and it hits you like a wave. They actually don't let you bring your cell phones in because, you know, for fear that some tiny little spark inside your cell phone is going to blow the roof off the whole thing because the air is so dense.
Well, because of where you are, the angel share is probably a lot higher. It's probably like 4%, huh?
8%.
8%, yeah. So
yeah,
it's huge.
Yeah, in Caribbean countries, the angel share ranges between 6 and 8%.
Yeah, so.
Okay, for someone who doesn't know what that means, just explain that to me.
Right, so.
Angel share.
It's basically how much evaporates.
Right, so, you know, talking about, you know, whiskey production, you know, originates in Scotland and Ireland. You know, Ireland's a very religious place, right? So, you know, if these Irish guys are getting a bit upset that, you know, not half of their whiskey, but 2% a year in Ireland of their whiskey is just evaporating out of the barrels. Well, you know, they can say the angels took it.
The angels are having a nice drink.
But then when
upstairs.
You go to a warmer climate, higher temperatures, more evaporation.
More evaporation,
so it's just going to bring it up. That's why when you think about the aging process of, like, if you think about a high end scotch, it's like an 18 year scotch takes probably 6 years in down in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
Because it's just so much more warmer and you get more extraction through the barrels that way.
Ah, I see.
So that's really what it comes down to.
Science.
So weirdly enough, I was actually, like, just to bring up in Venezuela, I was watching Last Week Tonight with John Oliver this morning. Mm-hmm. And if you guys have never seen the show, it's like fantastic. And he generally picks like one topic every Sunday and kind of expounds on it. And it usually has like some sort of political spin. Well, this week he talked about Venezuela and all the stuff that's going on in Venezuela right now and how that country is basically starving and how their current president, the one who replaced Hugo Chavez, is basically just, I mean, obviously it's South America, so pretty much every government is corrupt, but he's like, basically turned their currency into worth being literally worth nothing. Like, they show in the clip that, like, if you go to the grocery store, they don't even count your money. They just weigh it because it's worth literally, their inflation rate right now is 13,000%.
Yeah, it was pretty sad.
Wild, and it's so sad.
Yeah.
When we got off the plane and we got off this little tiny private jet that they took us down there, actually the jet was this tiny little, you know, Cessna Citation with these big stuffy armchairs with like gold cigar ashtrays. Totally reminded me of something you'd see in Narcos.
Yeah.
We get off the plane and the first thing the brand ambassador does is hand us a huge stack of money. Like, I'm talking like the size of a brick. And we're looking at this and going like, wow, how much money is this?
It's probably like $5.
$5.
It was $2.
It was $2.
So, wow. You know, as funny as that story is, it's really, really sad because that currency has been inflated into nothing. And so, you know, average salary for somebody that might have been enough to provide for them in, you know, decades past. That country was one of the most successful economies of South America up until the price of oil plummeted a couple years ago. Mm. But now, like, their monthly salaries for your average worker are like $4 or $5 a month. And it's, you know, they have a hard time getting all their necessities of life. Water, for example, is more expensive than gasoline. Like it's
they have the most oil in the world. They have the richest oil reserves in the world.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Like, think about just, that. Just horribly, horribly mismanaged.
They sue. How was your experience in Venezuela?
It was incredible. Yeah, yeah, it was incredible. You know, similar to Bacardi, they took us to their production facility and we really got to touch every aspect of the production. So on the first day, they took us to their environmental treatment area.
This is for Diplomatico.
This is for Diplomatico rum, yeah. So a little bit of background. This was one of the other competitions that I was regionally successful in last year. And then we went to the North American finals, which they actually held in Aruba instead of Venezuela because at the time, Venezuela was just too politically unstable. So we had the competition in Aruba. Which was definitely not a bad thing. They put us up in the Ritz on the beach for a week, which was
not too
shabby. Pretty nice.
It's doable.
But they also said, you know, we're really sorry for you know, inconveniencing you with this beach holiday. So, you know, we'll take you back to Venezuela as soon as it chills out. And they did do that. And it was this very hastily organized thing where, like, you know, with like a week's notice, they're like, okay, like we're going to Aruba or we're going to Venezuela, excuse me, you know, we're just going to get you to Miami and we'll figure it out from there. From there, we stay there one night. The next morning, okay, we're going to the Dominican Republic and then we're going to get on a private plane and we're going to fly to Venezuela. And so flight to the Dominican Republic, change airports, you know, drive down this little dirt road to, you know, the other airport and get on this tiny plane, you know, with barely enough space for like five people, get up in the air and then be told that, well, actually, we might not land in Venezuela. Because air traffic control is not responding, so we might go somewhere else.
Was there any part of you here where you were kind of questioning your decision to go on?
Well, we were currently focused on the two bottles of rum they said we had to finish by the time we landed. So yeah, we were having a good time. Yeah, my buddy Kevin Berry from Three Dots and a Dash, he hates flying, so you know we were definitely
rum helps. Yeah,
yeah, rum helps for sure.
Three Dots and a Dash, that's Chicago, right?
Chicago bar, yeah. So. He's the guy that ended up winning the North American finals in Aruba. He went to London, competed for the global finals. He wasn't ultimately successful, but man, amazing bartender. Anyway, back to Venezuela. You know, we're over Curaçao and they say, hey, guess what? We have great news. We're going to Venezuela. And so we went to Venezuela. They put us up in a really nice hotel in a town called Barquisimeto, which is like probably like the third biggest city in Venezuela. And then the distillery is like maybe an hour out of town. And the first day they took us to their environmental treatment plant, which I was thinking would be kind of boring. Like, you know, okay, sure. You're going to show us your sustainability efforts. You know, it's kind of like this token brand thing so you can, you know, eat this up. But it was actually really, really cool. So basically, I mean, they take what they call the vinasa, which is the runoff after distillation. And they pump that into these big open conditioning tanks where they actually decrease the pH. And then dilute it. And then that then gets pumped into their cane fields as fertilizer and as a natural pest deterrent. So they actually get to completely eliminate chemical fertilizers and chemical pesticides from their cane production. So it's a super sustainable process and enables that rum company to be one of the more sustainable rum companies in South America.
Is that a common practice?
It's not.
It's not.
No, it's not.
So just Diplomatico's.
I was reading up on what... some Jamaican rum companies do. And that stillage is a technical term, that runoff. In Jamaica, they refer to it as dunder. And then that goes into basically a big pit where they add the cane trash, so like the trimmings from the sugar cane, as well as sort of like the sediment from their washbacks. And they just let that kind of ferment into this like big acidic bacterial bolus. And they call that the muck. And then that's what then gets added to their fermented molasses before distillation, which then is what produces all these crazy fruity esters that end up in like really funky Jamaican rums.
So anyone out there who doesn't know much about the production of rum is made from the byproduct of making sugar, which is molasses. Mm-hmm. Some rums can be caramelized molasses if you want like a darker style rum. Venezuelan rum is the Diplomatico, which is generally more of a richer, kind of a little bit sweeter style.
Getting back to Diplomatico, we also went to the aging warehouse. Very impressive. Nothing on the scale of Bacardi's, but as soon as you walk in, you just get hit with this like wall of evaporating rum. It's incredible. On the next day, we went to the distillery and learned a bit more about their distillation process. So as Jamie mentioned, rum is basically a distillate of a byproduct of sugar. So there's two ways of making rum. One is to take the sugarcane juice and distill that ferment and distill that right away. So that's called rum agricole. It's relatively uncommon and sort of limited to French Caribbean islands. The reason for that is that those islands never needed to actually make industrial sugar and ship it back to France, because France always had a native domestic sugar industry with sugar beets. Whereas the British and Caribbean, British and Spanish Caribbean islands always had to make sugar to send back to the home country. What they would be left with after the sugar production process, so once you've heated up and centrifuged all the crystallized sugar out of the cane juice, what you have left over is molasses. It's basically industrial waste. You add some water to that, ferment that, distill that. That's rum industrial and what we know of as rum. In Venezuela, they use molasses for about half of their rums. The rest of their rums, they use fermented sugarcane honey, which is basically sugarcane juice that's been evaporated to concentrate the sugar content. So it's a little bit like molasses in that it has these really nice, like, caramelly cooked flavors, but the sugar content's much higher. And so they're really super premium sipping rums that go through their heavy distillation process, heavy rum distillation process using pot stills. They are all made of sugarcane honey. And so once all of their rums have gone through a single stage column run, they call it the wine still, to get that up to the low wine, sort of like the 30% alcohol. Then they redistill that through a variety of different stills. The first one, the main one, being the Barbet column. So the Barbet column is like an early 19th century French design that has these very intricate retorts where the distilled alcohol gets placed back into the columns at different positions and really results in this light rum that has a lot of flavor to it. So the basic science with distillation is the higher you distill something, the more flavor you're pulling out of it. So right. The beauty of the Barbet column still is getting a rum that's really high in alcohol but still really flavor dense. So that's okay. One still they use. The other one is called a batch kettle. Think of a massive 10-meter tall drum. Basically looks like a keg on its side with a little small column still on top of that. And so that's actually from the Canadian whiskey production process. So they
Seagram's probably?
Yeah. Mm. So the Diplomatico distillery, Duza, in Venezuela, is formerly a Seagram's facility. So they brought this batch kettle still, this ugly whiskey pig of a still down to Venezuela.
Anybody out there looking to get a bachelor's degree in rum knowledge, keep listening.
So they brought this weird still down to Venezuela to make whiskey, which they still actually do. And so their domestic market for basically all spirits is made there. Their big export product, of course, is Diplomatico.
Yeah.
The third still, which is really the beauty of this distillery, aside from the Barbet column, which is awesome, is their two copper pot stills, which are directly brought in from Scotland, and they are amazing. And that is what they use to distill their really heavy cane honey rums that go into their really high-end sipping rums, like the Ambassador, like the single vintage, and to a great extent, the Diplomatico Reserva Exclusiva, which is the main product that you get.
Yeah.
Fucking delicious.
See, I find that really interesting because the only spirits that I've ever known to be copper pot distilled are obviously Ketel One and Tito's.
So
and those are vodkas. I didn't think.
Yeah. So
I know that Absolute, well, I think, had one for their Elixir.
Cognac.
Yeah. So copper pot stills are basically what you're going to use to distill almost all Scotch whiskeys, all single malt.
So that's
whiskeys.
Why it's of note. This is for a
double
vodka.
You're doing a double distillation, right? It's right. Generally what you're using copper pot stills for. Anything longer than that, like if you want to do like a triple.
So most dark spirits, most whiskeys, and rums.
It's actually an interesting question to ask. So basically, simplifying it to the extreme, there are basically two methods of distilling. So the first is a linear method. So you basically take a heat source, heating your wash, so your low wines, and then you're evaporating the alcohol. Alcohol boils off at a lower temperature than water, and then recondensing them. So the best way to do that is a pot still. So think about a pot, like something you're going to have in your kitchen, and then just put a condenser on top of that. So a sort of swan neck conical shape that basically captures all that evaporating alcohol and then condenses it. So that's a pot still. Generally speaking, pot stills distill any spirit to a lower alcoholic proof than the other method, which is continuous distillation in a column still. So with a pot still, you get a lower proof spirit that retains more of the characteristics of the substrate, so the base ingredient, right? So if you're distilling rum in a pot still, the final product is going to be much richer, much heavier, much oilier, and it's going to have a lot more of that residual characteristics of the sugarcane. If you are distilling the other way with continuous distillation in a column still, basically you're just spinning the product around and around and around and around.
So you basically strip it until it's nothing.
You can, or
so you get vodka.
If you keep going all the way to its full extent of the process, you eventually get a very neutral spirit, which is something similar to vodka. Vodka, basically, take whatever your base material is, whether it's sugar beets, whether it's potatoes, whether it's, you know, grain such as barley, rye, or wheat, distill that all the way up to 96.5% alcohol, at which point the boiling rates of alcohol and water actually converge. So you can't get it any higher than that. Filter it a bunch of times, water it down, that's vodka. But, I mean, you can distill anything that way. And you don't necessarily have to take it all the way up to 96% alcohol. If you run a column still and run it up to 80%, you know, there's still going to be leftover flavor. The body of the spirit is just going to be lighter than what you get out of a pot still. So, for example, bourbon, most of it is double columned, you know, distilled up to like 80%, for example.
Yeah.
So bourbon still has a ton of corn flavor. I mean, it is just a lighter spirit than something you would get out of a pot still. So say like, think single malt whiskey. It's a lot heavier. It's a lot oilier. There's a lot more residual esters and aldehydes left in the final product. So yeah, there's two methods. One is heavier. One is lighter. So
okay. So since we're talking about rum and distillation, I had a question about reverse charcoal filtering with rum, because we were talking about the last podcast with Chris, and I was telling him about this overproof rum called Rum Fire that you can only get in rum the States, fire. Which, do you know of it?
I love Rum Fire.
He loves
love
Rum Fire.
I
tried it with him the other, like, two nights ago.
Two nights ago?
Yeah.
Wow. It's all coming together.
Rum Fire. It's dope. Rum Fire.
Where did you get a bottle?
Rum Fire is a sexy beast. Yeah. Rum Fire is insane. So
the label's.
So I tried it last year for the first time.
The label makes it look like a cheap $5 rum.
It looks like it's like something like a lamb's plastic bottle, like the 60-liter with the
it
handle.
It looks like something you would get like in a third world country, you know, out of a plastic jug. You know, it's got like this crazy, you know, super bold font. It says Rum Fire. It's got blue flames in one direction and red flames in the other direction.
Yeah.
Like, it looks like something Guy Fieri would drink when you take to a party or something.
Yeah, the label design is the Guy Fieri.
And you brought it out and you're like, dude, you got to try this. And I was just like,
that's so funny that you had it and that we were just talking about it last week.
So you had it.
I had it because we were doing a bar training session, which was 2 days. And our instructor had brought it from the States because her name's Kate. She was actually the general manager of the Rumba in Seattle.
Okay. So Rumba, that is like the coolest rum bar probably on the West Coast.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe Smuggler's Cove in San Francisco competes, but, holy moly. Rumba is insane.
Yeah, I was there in February with
she's
a friend
the GM of
mine. She was, but she's not anymore.
So she's probably got, you know, infinitely more rum geekiness than I do.
So she gave us a little rum.
I can bow down to her.
Yeah, she kind of got me, because I didn't really know too much about it. She kind of got me sort of learning about rum.
Okay, so I know how I felt about it, but what turned you on to it when you tried it?
Yeah, so what the cool thing about Rum Fire, which is actually when I was talking about Jamaican rums and their muck pits and their dunder fermentations, so that article was talking about Hampton Estate, which is the distillery in Jamaica that makes Rum Fire. And so that's the way that they basically get these super, super estery rums. Estery, by the way, refers to this geeky rum term, ester. So that's basically when an acid meets with alcohol, you get an ester. So say acetic acid, which is vinegar, for example, when that binds with ethyl alcohol, produces ethyl acetate, which is an ester. And so ethyl acetate just smells like cooked sugar.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you add acids to your wash, the mix that you're going to end up distilling, what that does is it actually supercharges the ester-making process. And so what Hampton Estate will do is they'll take the muck, which is basically all the garbage from the cane fields, all of the runoff from their stills, all of the lees from their washbacks and from their still retorts, and just let that ferment and go bad for weeks in these pits, open air fermentation. And it's just this like malevolent bacterial, like
gnarly,
super gnarly thing, right? And so
I don't want that joke.
They just like they dose a bit of this muck into the wash, basically the fermented molasses. Mm-hmm. They dose that with a bit of the muck right before distillation, and all this acidic, basically like vinegar that's produced by bacteria, mm-hmm. right? You take any sugar material, allow acetobacteria to get at it. These are vinegar making bacteria. It's going to acidify it. It's going to lower the pH, and it's going to produce all these weird, probably toxic, you know, vinegars.
Probably.
Which, you know, once it gets through the distillation process are totally separated. This is totally safe, you know, but the flavors that are combined by combining all these weird, funky fermented acids with alcohol is just this immense, funky, overripe banana, pineapple, chocolate. Yeah. Like you smell this, this rum, and it's unaged entirely. No age on it at all. And it's overproof. Like we're talking like 65% alcohol, and you just pop the top off this thing. And the first thing you just,
it's funky.
You get hit with a wall of estuary funk. So in parts per million, which, you know, they do for peat in Scotch whiskeys, you know, I think like a big funky overproof rum, like Ray and Nephew comes in at like 100 parts per million.
They do an overproof one as well, right?
Ray and Nephew overproof is a rum that's available in Canada. It's another Jamaican funky.
I'm pretty sure there's an empty bottle in my kitchen right now.
Yeah, it's great stuff. So if that comes in at 100 parts per million of the ester count, rum fire is like 500. So it's like five times the fruity, funky, estery punch. And so the amount of flavor that you can add to a cocktail with that rum is just like staggering. So
yeah, I guess that's why I sort of really enjoyed it, because it was different than any, like there was no, I'm used to rums being a lot sweeter, just the ones I've been exposed to. Mm-hmm. And this is like the complete opposite.
So. Or a lot cleaner, right? So take, for example, Bacardi, right? Their Carta Blanca white rum probably has the lowest ester count of any rums. It's super, super, super neutral. So
probably why the people love it too, right? It's just,
I mean, if you're going to mix Bacardi white rum and soda, like that's, they call it a mismo. It's like basically the...
They call it a mismo?
Mismo, yeah. So it's basically the Caribbean's answer to a vodka soda. It's delicious, right? Like if you want something like super light and refreshing and like, you know, you're out on a Friday night and you don't even want to think about what you're drinking. I mean, some people don't.
Or you're watching your weight.
Or you're watching
Beach bod.
Sure, yeah. Beach bod.
Yeah.
Mismo.
Mismo. Yeah.
I love when people come to the bar and be like, I want to keep my calorie count down, but then I'm going to have 14 vodka sodas. Like, 14. Really?
Well, that's better than 14 beers, I suppose.
Hey, man, alcohol is probably one of the most calorie-dense things out there. If you want to watch your weight, like, just stay off the salt.
Yeah, just stop drinking.
Or, you know, maybe just take it all in moderation. Moderation's key, right? You know, people will come in and they'll tell me they want a margarita without sugar, or they want a mojito without sugar. And
just have one.
I think you guys were talking about this, like, with Chris in the last podcast. I think any acidic drink without sugar is just a travesty, right? Like you need sugar to balance the acidity. Otherwise, it doesn't even taste sour. Like a margarita, a daiquiri mojito without sugar does not actually taste sour. It tastes like dirt, right? Your palate is so overwhelmed with the low pH of what's coming across it that you don't even taste anything. It just tastes like bitter booze water, and like, you know, it's just like, it's just not very good.
It's a thing now. Like I get this often. I had this yesterday. This lady and her daughter came in. One lady wanted a margarita, less sugar. And I was like, okay. And then her mom was like, even less than that. And I was like, so none? I was just like, and I was fine. And Sean, it's exactly what you just said. I tasted it. And I was just like, ugh. And it's like, it's not enjoyable.
I mean,
if you don't want sugar, get a glass of wine.
There is no accounting for taste, of course, but you know, taste is a very subjective thing. But I think that, like, you know, if you're going to enjoy a cocktail, why not just enjoy one really good cocktail and then just stop there, as opposed to maybe overindulging, maybe having four or five cocktails and just having ones that are lower in sugar because you think it's better for you. I think, you know, have one really great cocktail and then call it a day if you're really worried about your sugar intake. And, you know, you should be. Sugar's bad for you, right? So is alcohol. But everything in moderation, you know? I think, you know, overindulging is definitely something that, you know, we see every day. And, it's if you're gonna cut back on the sugar, you might as well just cut back on the booze.
Our health tip of the day, by the way.
Yeah, take it to account. Yeah. So you're telling me I can get, if I come to your bar, you have rum fire?
No. You can come to my home bar.
Oh, okay, yes.
Yeah. Club Sean.
Official invite.
It's open
right.
Every time my girlfriend's out of town. And usually the only people there are Jamie and Todd from the Paramount Pacific Rim.
And now Mick.
Well, Seb, now that you've been talking a lot about all this, we did this last time, and Mick kind of put me on the spot on this one.
Uh-huh.
Name us your three favorite rums.
Yes.
Man, that's like asking your three favorite kids.
Well, you don't have any kids, so it's...
Right, that's true. I would say that right now, because, things change, I might forget about a rum and then come back to it later or, experience something new that's going to blow it out of the water. But for right now, just off the top of my head, my three favorite rums in my current collection right now, the first one, Diplomático Ambassador. It's a 12-year-old rum, all pot stills, all cane honey, and it's aged in American oak barrels, former bourbon barrels, for 12 years. And then they add a further 2 years aging in former Pedro Jimenez barrels. And it's exquisite.
What is that?
PX, yeah. That's a type of sherry.
PX is okay. Pedro Jimenez is a type of sherry. It's sweet, not a dry sherry.
Sweet sherry.
So sherries, there's two styles. There's sweet and dry.
Right.
And within each category, sweet and dry, there's a bunch of different ways of doing it. Pedro Jimenez is actually a different grape than most sherries are made from. Most sherries are made from the Palomino grape. Pedro Jimenez is its own grape. And it is like raisiny and dense and sugary. And some of these Pedro Jimenez has come out
delicious.
In the bottle with Jamie, you're the one guy, correct me, but some of them are at 30 bricks. So for 50 bricks is simple syrup, just in case anyone wants to know. So they're sweet.
Super thick.
They're like grape jam,
like
black currant and,
Yeah, like
fig.
A bottle of
getting to the port, in the port territory?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, totally.
Like a bottle
it's
of
very reminiscent of port. Maybe more sugar dense and red fruit flavor.
A bottle of the Listowel PX is probably I think it's 20% alcohol, but it's sweet, and you hit it right on the nose. Raisiny. You're getting a lot of those kind of dried fruit flavors. Mm-hmm. And it's stunning. It's delicious.
That's interesting practice for aging for
this,
a rum.
Take this cask finish and stick that for 2 years, which, 2 years is quite a long time in the Caribbean. Because it's so hot, the temperature, makes the wood really absorbent, right? So that rum is going in and out of that barrel and absorbing just all the juice that's in there. So it's picking up just lovely flavors. And number two was a gift that we got from the Bacardi distillery, which is their, it's called the Casa Reserva. So they only give this to distillery visitors. I actually got to bottle it myself. I haven't cracked open my bottle of it, but I've certainly helped myself to Mike Shum's bottle of it. And again, I don't know what it's finished in, but there's definitely a sherry cask influence to it. The rum is super red, and a lot of people go oh yeah, Bacardi, I mix that with Coke, but that distillery is capable of making some absolute bangers of really flavorful woody rums.
I'm going to kind of cheat here for you for your third one.
Oh, don't cheat on me, baby. I already have one. Okay, I already have one.
So what
out.
I would ask is, so you've named two rums right now.
I already have my third one. Don't cheat on me.
For your first two rums, you've named two rums that probably most people will have a trouble. Like
we'll never
trouble
have
finding.
In their lifetime.
Can you pick one rum that you think is more commercially available that you really love?
Oh, but I had such a good one for my third one.
Give us four.
Oh, yeah, okay, give us four.
Okay, I'll give you four. So my third one, it actually touches on the rum fire. Right? Yeah. So, and this is actually available to all you Vancouverites who are, in the market for a crazy rum. If you go to Legacy Liquor Store, you can pick up this rum that I'm talking about. They probably only have four or five bottles left. So, hopefully a few lucky listeners get in on this.
I kind of know where I'm going later.
But so Hampton Estate, the distillery we're talking about, makes Rum Fire, has the Muck Pit. They don't usually age their rums, but there's a Scotch bottler called Adelphi. It's a private bottler. Usually they just pick up casks from different Scotch distilleries, release them as private blendings. They picked up a cask of rum of Hampton Estate. I'm not sure if it was Rum Fire, but it was Hampton Estate rum. They aged it for 15 years. So 15 years of maturation on one of the highest ester funk bombs of a rum. And this thing is amazing. So take what you get in Rum Fire and just let that relax for 15 years on oak. And it's exquisite.
And what's it called?
It's called the Hampton Estate Adelphi 15-year-old.
Mm. Is that, and you can get a couple bottles of that at Legacy?
I picked up one as a nice little present to myself.
What was that cost?
That was a 200.
After today, there'll be none left because I'm going to go grab all six.
It was a $200 bottle of rum.
Maybe not. Maybe just one.
Well worth the price of admission. There you go. That's my top three.
And what was the fourth accessible one?
The fourth accessible one.
If you had to pick one.
If I had to pick an accessible rum. El Dorado 15.
Yes, that's mine.
I know that's your number one.
Yeah, that's my favorite. Yeah.
I don't know why I know that. I heard that.
El Dorado 15, super underpriced. That rum is so underpriced. It's like $60 at the BCL.
And it's unbelievable.
Like, it's great.
I love that rum.
I put that stuff on waffles. It's amazing.
You never had El Dorado 15?
Once upon a time, maybe.
Oh, it's great.
So for me being a complete rum noob, over the last year, I've been sort of like drinking more of them. But my number one is obviously Rumfire because it's the only one I've been exposed to that's of that ilk. I've always liked Appleton's.
Appleton's is great. I had a tasting with Joy Spence, their master distiller, one of the only female master distillers in the rum world. She's amazing.
Well, Appleton's is really huge.
It definitely tastes different than anything else. I've always felt it has like a sort of like a eucalyptus-y kind of like finish, like a really lifting finish, as opposed to like a sweeter. Yeah. And even the color of it is different than most rums I've found.
Yeah, well, I mean, they have a whole range of different rums, and they're all drier for sure.
Not
adding sugar to the rum definitely makes it drier. Yeah. So Kevin Berry of Three Dots and a Dash, the guy who took the North American finals with Diplomatico, I'm going to go visit him in a week or so in Chicago.
Nice.
He's a rum geek, and I really look up to that guy. And his rule with the daiquiri is the rule of three. So the daiquiri, so for those of you who are imagining like strawberries and blended in a hurricane glass in Mexico, get that idea out of your head right now. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the classic Cuban daiquiri. So lots of rum, you know, about two parts of rum, and then one part of like freshly squeezed lime juice, you know, from a hand reamer, so lots of citrus oil in there. And then, you know, a little bit south of one part of sugar just to balance that that citrusiness. And then so the outcome is just this really short, snappy, rum-forward, tart zinger of a cocktail, and that's a daiquiri. Anyhow, the daiquiri in Kevin Beery's world has the rule of three, which I'm sure the guys at Rumba would agree with. Mm-hmm. So the rule of three is that your daiquiri should involve no less than three rums.
Okay.
You should finish it in no more than three sips.
Okay.
And you should have three of them.
Three sips? I like that. That's pretty good, actually.
That's good. I like that.
Okay, so.
Wise words to live by.
Yeah. Thank you, Kevin Berry.
Mick, do you feel like you've just gotten a master's degree in rum?
I feel like my brain is like almost about to explode with rum.
I hope
right
all
now.
You listeners are enjoying this, by the way, because I'm really enjoying this. This is I could listen to Sean talk about rum. And
we're just you can't see, but we're just like our hands are on our chins are on our fists, and we're just like staring at Sean talking.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, like, this is like one of the, like, I mean, outside of like having known Sean and one, you know, knowing that he competes, and I wanted to talk to him about his Diageo experience, but I was really, really curious to kind of wax and kind of just get let him run and talk about rum. And we haven't gotten about his other passion, which is Amaro.
Oh, yeah, we should talk about that. Well, just for consistency's sake, my third one would probably be Ronza Kappa. And I don't know if that's a good rum or a bad one.
Delicious rum. Amazing rum. So that was one of the rums that we used in our Diageo World Class. That's one of the flagship brands of Diageo, the Diageo Reserve portfolio. And so, that was in quite a few of my cocktails in the World Class Finals in Montreal.
What about yours, Jamie? I know El Dorado's one.
Yeah, El Dorado 15 by far. Probably the Diplomatico Reserva number two. I'm more prone to the sweetness.
I know about your sweet tooth, chocolate cake, cookies.
Jeez, I'm a cookie guy.
Such a fat kid.
I'm more preferable to those. And I'd probably say the Ronza Kappa. So I like that one a lot too. I will say, like, I love rum. Don't get me wrong. I will always take a beautiful daiquiri and a great rum cocktail, but it's lower on my list when it comes to like spirits that I like the most.
Ah, right.
So like definitely I like, I'm more of a cognac gin.
You like
more
of the wine?
I'm probably more a mezcal guy. Oh. Yeah. Like just sipping it neat.
Actually, as a segue to what we'll talk about next, I've always found that Appleton's and Averna pair perfectly together.
That's a great combination. Great combination.
I have a feeling Sean has a pretty good insight to this one as well, because I've been to his house and he has, how many Amaros would you say you have?
I think at last count, it was about 30.
And how many rums?
About 30.
Okay, that's not bad.
Pretty decent.
Okay,
so
it's growing all the time, much to my girlfriend's chagrin. She, we're in Hawaii a couple weeks ago, and it's my thing. You know, every time we go to the States, which has, you know, fabulously more.
Infinitely more products
like
available.
It's amazing. You know, I think more than just, you know, it's not necessarily just that the Estates has an amazing selection. It's that we have a really shitty one. If anybody at the British Columbia Liquor Control Board is listening, man, you guys need to step up your game.
Terrible. I went to the Whiskey Library for the first time like 4 years ago, and I saw stuff in Portland.
There's a whiskey library. I'm going to Portland.
It's called the Whiskey Library.
The Multnomah Whiskey Library. It's amazing.
And I saw stuff that I had no idea, one, existed, two, that you could even do. Like there was like 56 year age Macallan stuff. Yeah. Like it was just crazy for me, not really sort of getting out and cocktailing in other countries or even other cities in Canada. Yeah. I was astonished.
Well,
it was
so like stuff in British Columbia,
it's a bar or what is this?
It's a bar.
So it's a bar.
It's a bar.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. It's good. I'm looking for bars to go to. Do you want to talk about some of your favorite Amaros?
Yeah, sure.
First of all, for our listeners,
what is an Amaro?
An Amaro, I believe, is a liqueur.
That's true. Yes, it is.
Not a vermouth liqueur.
So, starting at like the very high level, so Amaro in Italian means bitter.
Yes.
Right? So, the plural of Amaro, it's not Amaros, it's Amari. So, Amari are bitter liqueurs, generally designed as a digestivo, so something to have after a meal. So, these are typically rich, some of them are quite sweet, and they have very concentrated flavor of the botanicals that are infused into them, right? So every little village in Italy has their own Amaro. And so this would basically be all of the medicinal plants that were available to 19th century and even 18th century pharmacists, laboristas of the day, who were basically like the medicine men in the village, right? So, you know, any medicinal plants that they have access to, so gentian, cinchona, you know, cinnamon, you know, whatever it is that they can get their hands on, they're going to infuse this into alcohol, much in the way that, you know, monks in France would infuse different herbs and plants. And
chartreuse.
Chartreuse, exactly, yes. Right? So the original purpose of alcohol and doing a maceration or infusion of plants is to take on their medicinal properties. But in addition to any medicinal properties that you're extracting with the alcohol, you're also extracting all the flavor, right? And so the main function of this is for use as a digestive. So it actually helps digestion. So the human palate, when it detects anything bitter, it actually triggers like an early evolutionary part of your brain, which basically tells you might be getting poisoned, right? If you were, you know, a caveman, I know it sounds really heavy, right? But if you're a caveman you're like, you know, roaming around the Paleolithic era and you're, you know, you're just munching on random plants you come across, you try something bitter, hey man, there's a pretty good chance that it could be poison. And so it was of evolutionary benefit to our ancestors to have bitter flavors stimulate a accelerated digestion, right? Uh-huh. So you taste something bitter and it's going to, you know, it's going to speed up digestion. So if you just like, you know, scarf down, you know, a big bowl of carbonara, something really dense, Italian food can be pretty heavy, lots of cheese, lots of cream, you know, having one of these digestivos, an Amaro, is definitely going to help you out in addition to being very delicious.
Another beer that most people will probably know would be Campari.
Yeah, so actually this ties in, mentioning Campari ties in neatly to sort of the opposite of Amaro, which is a bitter. So it's confusing in Italian, Amaro means bitter, but in Italy they refer to products such as Campari or Aperol as bitters, right? So Amaro, think dense, dark, opaque, you know, thick and
very viscous.
Well, some are more or less viscous than others, but it's definitely a heavier product than, say, something like Aperol or Campari. So clear, red, bright, citrusy. There's bitterness to it, but it's not as heavy. So that would be referred to as an herbal bitter, and that's more of an aperitivo, right? So you have an Aperol spritz, Campari soda, the Americano cocktail, a Negroni. These are all aperitivo.
Well, the red that came from Campari for the longest time up until recently didn't come from a beer.
Cochineal beetles. Crushed up beetles. Yeah, which actually is...
Yeah, they stopped doing that recently.
Yeah, it's unfortunate because, like, you know, it's basically a, you know, organic, non-artificial color.
Do you know why they switched?
I think it's cheaper, maybe more consistent.
Are they just adding dye now?
Yeah, yeah, no, it's just an artificial. I mean, I'm sure it's like naturally derived, but it's
how a long? Chem, it's how, a, when did they switch?
This is like probably last like what 10 years or so.
Oh, okay,
something like that. Yeah. I don't actually know like the.
So you're telling me the date, coloring in Campari was crushed up
beetles, yeah. Big time.
Yeah.
Wow.
From nature.
That's amazing.
Nature is a natural red dye.
Well, I mean, that's like one of the things.
I've been thinking
about
eating more bugs just for protein.
But yeah, it's very sustainable.
Have you guys heard
about
it?
Big in South America.
M&M's, that's the thing that they're trying to go through. They were going through recently is that, or I think it was M&M's or Smarties, that they were trying to get it where they wanted to use only natural colorings. And they were having trouble finding blue that naturally exists in the real world. So they were having trouble finding natural blue.
Huh.
So, and it's kind of
in the
that's
the
why blue curacao is like even Sons of Vancouver and great Vancouver liquor distilling company, really, you know, one of the pioneers of the Vancouver craft distilling movement. So they recently released a craft blue curacao, and this was like really nice aged brandy, you know, bitter curacao oranges, you know, but then of course, you know, they had to add the color blue, and there's no way to get around it. It's got to be fake. Because blue is a tough one. It's not found in nature. But yeah, getting back to Amaro,
mm-hmm.
Amari, one of the things that I am really excited about that category is that you're basically diving into this like antiquated world of like little Italian towns where like, you know, these little grandpas are sitting on the corner cafe and like after dinner and they like pull this dusty bottle off the back bar and like, you know, you got to like really pull the cap off because the sugar has just sort of caked it on there.
Mm-hmm.
And inside is just like 200 or 300 years of botanical infusing history. And it's just this really rich, like baking spice flavor. It really pairs well with whiskeys, with rums.
Mm-hmm.
You can use it in stirred cocktails. That's my favorite application for it. But also in shaken cocktails, a great one is like the paper plane, for example.
Yeah, that comes with Amaro Nonino.
Yeah, Amaro Nonino, which is
made from grappa.
Yeah, grappa-based Amaro with Aperol, which is a bitters. So mm-hmm. Think Campari's little sister, less bitter, similar sugar content. And then bourbon and lemon juice. So that's like one of your classic, you know, modern classic cocktails.
Have you ever had a paper plane?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, you've had those before.
Delicious,
they're
yeah.
They're actually quite popular now. You say, like, I was at Earl's last week. And,
yeah.
One and the, they're on their menu.
Yeah.
I was like,
on the menu.
But they're not doing Amaro Nonino. They're actually using Amaro no Montenegro, which
cheaper.
I was actually just in Saskatoon and I went to this pizza place down there, Una Pizza place. And my friend of mine works there. And they were doing the same things. They were doing paper planes, but they were using Amaro Montenegro, mostly just because it's a lot more readily available.
Yeah.
It's hard to get Amaro Nonino.
It's less expensive. So,
and probably less expensive.
It's definitely
But it
less
still
expensive.
Tastes really good. Like I've made paper planes before with Averna.
Yeah. It's definitely, sure. It's a better drink with Nonino. It balances better. The drink was created by a really famous New York bartender, Sam Ross, for the opening menu of the Violet Hour in Chicago. And it's one of two of Sam Ross's drinks that's actually gone like wall to wall to wall. The other one is, of course, the penicillin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've ever been to a bar that can make good cocktails, you could throw out either of those names around the world, and they'd know how to make them. Which is like,
what's in the penicillin?
He invented both.
That's pretty cool.
What's in the penicillin?
So the penicillin,
does that have absinthe in it?
No.
It's
so
a Scotch
penicillin
cocktail.
is a blended Scotch whiskey.
Okay.
With a peated single malt Scotch whiskey, honey, lemon, and ginger. Yeah, it's sort of like a smoky honey, ginger, lemon whiskey sour.
Why are we not drinking cocktails right now?
You were supposed to bring wine.
Yeah, I screwed up.
Instead,
God
we're
damn
drinking
it, Jamie. And the wine collection. Yeah, we're drinking basically monkey piss.
By the way,
it's not bad. It's not bad.
Mickey's selection of wine is god awful.
I enjoy cheap white wine. I don't know what's wrong with me.
Says the wine snob / bartender scribe, yes. Jamie Maw. The intellectual bent of the cocktail program of the Fairmont Pacific Rim. Thanks, Van Meg.
Hey, Van Meg, I'll take that shout out anytime.
I enjoyed it.
It's all right. No. Jamie definitely needed his ego to be pumped up.
It's working right now, actually.
No. It's good. I like it. That's the reason why we're here, right? Yeah, but yeah, vermouth and Amari have like a very like intricate.
They cross over.
They cross over a lot. Yeah. There's definitely a synergistic relationship there. Like, for example, there's an Amaro that I just brought back from Hawaii, which incidentally, I brought it to bring to World Class in Montreal. And then when I got to World Class in Montreal, there it was on the, you know, communal ingredient table. Have it in Montreal. This is called Cardamaro, and it's produced from a plant called, the cardoon, which is, I think, a relative of the artichoke. Any case, it's,
So you, brought this special ingredient.
I did.
Saw it was on the.
Yeah, yeah, and that went in my kata for the third challenge at Diageo World Class Canada, which was actually where the octopus came in.
Okay.
So that was the third challenge is called the Signature Serve. We had to make a cocktail that was inspired by our bars. So the Lobby Lounge at the Fairmont Pacific Rim, obviously it's a high volume cocktail bar in a luxury hotel, but it's also a sushi restaurant. So we take a big Japanese influence from our sushi program and our sushi chefs and then apply that to our cocktail program. So the hotel is also really obsessed with art. Our owner, Ian Gillespie, is a real art aficionado.
Mm-hmm.
And so the crossover between art and Japan, there was recently an exhibit at the art gallery called The Octopus Eats Its Own Leg. Takashi Murakami, he's a Japanese pop artist. He's collaborated
It's so dope.
I haven't seen it. It's done.
It's done?
It's done.
I saw it. It was unbelievable.
I went twice.
It's so dope.
But, it's an installation or a sculpture?
No, it's a whole exhibit, right? So
he's
all his paintings and sculptures.
One of the biggest artists.
Lithographs.
World.
Yeah. So his like one of his claims to fame, he has many. But one of them is he produced the graduation album for Kanye West.
Like the artwork for it.
The bear.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was going to say like he the
came
album.
Up,
like
came
what?
Up,
no, the art.
Came up with the Kanye bear.
The artwork. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So. And he does collaborations with like Louis Vuitton, but he is also this really serious, critical artist who takes traditional Japanese painting and then applies that to pop art. And so one of the sort of tenets of Japanese art is that it's all very flat in dimensionality. And his style is what he calls super flat. So there's an extra meaning here, which is that you're taking Japanese high art, high culture, and then combining that with pop culture, mass culture, and flattening that distinction.
Huh.
So it's flat in terms of its composition, but it's also flat in terms of its, you know, taking references from both high and mass culture and then flattening that out. So he's really cool if anybody has the opportunity to check him out. He's
absolutely
rad. But his exhibit was called The Octopus Eats Its Own Leg. So his theory there was that it's basically about himself. Like, so there's a Japanese phrase, the octopus eats its own leg. Basically, when an octopus is in times of stress, it'll consume its own leg to, you know, preserve itself, to sustain itself, knowing that the leg will grow back. And so with his creative process, he like pushes himself into a corner with deadlines and pressure and, you know, lots of stress. And it's at this point that he is able to like feed on himself and produce these really crazy ideas that he never would have thought of. And I think that there's an interesting parallel to draw that with cocktail competitions. You know, you have these deadlines that are, you know, bearing down on you and, you know, you still have to work your five shifts a week and you're just really fucking stressed. And that's when you produce some rad ideas. And so the idea for that was that it was a Japanese highball that this challenge.
Hold on.
Yeah.
Was this the one when I was at your bar 3 weeks ago? That you were workshopping, that you made for me? You made me the scotch soda?
It got better
for me. Okay, I just want to say to everyone listening that this drink was probably one of the best drinks I've ever had.
But it got better.
It was fantastic. It got better.
It got way better. It got so much better.
Okay, just tell us about the drink, because I thought it was amazing.
You know,
I don't know where you were, Jamie. You went to do something.
Yeah. I'm always there.
He was working or something.
So this was a riff on a Japanese highball, for anyone that doesn't know. Japanese highballs are an institution in Japan, and this is basically, you know, you walk into a bar, you say, I want the highball. And it's not like, oh, well, do you want like a gin and tonic, a vodka soda, rum and coke, da da da. No, no. It's always Japanese whiskey and soda.
Yep.
The end. Maybe a lemon twist.
That's like their thing?
That's it. Right? And so you get like freezer cold Japanese whiskey, like this big crystal ice cube, like hand cut probably in a frozen glass. They'll like slowly pour the whiskey over the ice and like the glass is frosting, and then they'll like take like this super carbonated soda and like slowly pour it in there so that like none of it hits the ice. Like basically it's like the absolute obsession with details in Japanese bartending. It's like the epitome of that.
Yeah.
In such like a, you know, a drink that you can just casually throw them back. You know, they're so refreshing and delicious. And I think for a like a Western audience, probably even like a bit plain, actually.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Like when we went ahead and made our own version of the Japanese highball for the Lobby Lounge program, it definitely has some boosted flavors in a yuzu cordial and genmaicha, fino sherry, and then some Amaro Montenegro. We batched the whole thing and then carbonated. And actually this cocktail for the competition was basically a riff on that. And, you know, full disclosure, I got the idea from the bar at PDT who does in New York, who did one with that, with there was a shrub, there was sherry, there was Amaro, and they carbonated the whole thing. And there was a lemon verbena tisane as well, and they carbonated the whole thing. It was amazing. Yeah.
So tisane, well, you can always borrow, you know.
Yeah, you know, I think creativity is about stealing other people's ideas and putting your own spin on them.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Anyhow, so my cocktail, which I call the Octopus Eats Its Own Leg, was Johnny Walker Blue Label Whiskey, luxury. Fairmont
only at the back room.
Always luxury. And then it was a Japanese plum wine, umeshu, which is really delicious. Has this great like stone fruit flavor. It's really soft and subtle. And then a yuzu cordial. So I used first pressing yuzu juice 2-to-1 with sugar. So 2 parts juice, 1 part sugar. And then a little bit of orange blossom water in there. And then I actually went out and picked a bunch of cherry blossoms on Cypress Street when the cherry blossoms were blooming. So the first of all the different species of cherry trees to bloom is the Fuji cherry tree. It's got these white petals and little red stems, and the smell is like, it's like maraschino liqueur. It's amazing. Anyway, so I was off like trying to be as like unshady as possible, like picking cherry blossoms. And like there's people like Instagramming like all this shit. And so I'm like picking these blossoms is like, and you can tell you're just getting like cut eye from everyone because like
they're all trying to take pictures.
Oh yeah, and here you are just like ripping cherry blossoms off of trees.
Just but it was dickhead. And they're like, what are you doing?
It was I definitely got a like, hey man, like what are you doing? And I was like, this is
like making a drink
cocktail project. Anyhow, yeah, so yeah, cherry blossom tincture, which turned out amazing.
It did. I agree.
It extracted like beautifully. Yeah. So I think next spring I'm going to like find a street where there aren't any tourists and just go to town. In any case, so that's I've talked about 4 ingredients so far. So there was a Johnny Blue, the plum wine, the cherry tincture, yuzu cordial. And then that fifth ingredient was an Amaro. And so the one that you tried was with Amaro Pasubio, which is a vino Amaro, kind of like card Amaro. And it has like this really piney, like blueberry flavor. It's very opaque and really delicious. It just didn't work in this cocktail. Like something was always kind of just not right with the cocktail. And then when I got back from Hawaii, I had, after tasting the card Amaro, I was like, you know what, this might work. And so I subbed it in there and holy moly, it was amazing. It was like everything just fell into place. So I served it on this like octopus sculpture. So it was like this, basically a tribute to the sculpture that was in basically the main foyer of the art gallery, which is like this like waterfall graffiti octopus thing. And it's amazing. You can look up Google images of it. And I kind of like made my own out of foam and paper mache and spray paint, got a little crafty. But then I did actually garnish it with an octopus tentacle, like a real octopus tentacle. My friend Gavin Miller works at a restaurant in Montreal called Jellyfish, and their chef Jesse was kind enough to actually get me an octopus, like a little popo, like a little like, you know, foot long baby octopus, and sous vide this thing with umeshu and yuzu, and then give me a glaze that I just applied, you know, the night before. And then I torched that in front of the judges and then served that like as a little like a side plate.
Wow.
So
jeez. Yeah.
Grant told me like off the record, well, this is on the record now, that he thought it was one of the best cocktails of the entire comp. So while I didn't win, and you know, would have liked to, but Chris Enns is gonna absolutely kill it for us. You know, I'm really happy with the effort that I put forward for this year, and I'm really stoked to get back at it next year.
And that's one of the main things I was really stoked about, like speaking to you afterwards about this whole experience, and you know, is the fact that you walked away from the whole thing, from what I gathered, with a very positive attitude, saying, you know what, I went out there and I did a really good job. And you know, the way you talk about this cocktail and how confident you feel, like, you know what, I nailed that one. And you know, like it shows good sportsmanship, and it shows that, you know, outside of the competing and the act of actually winning, that there's more to doing this than just winning. It's a process of it sounds like it's a process of love, that you love the craft of cocktails, the creativity, the inspiration, the whole process that leading up to it. The winning is, you know, is not, I wouldn't say tantamount, but it's part of it, but it's not everything. And I like how you've been able to walk away from it and be like, you know what, I'm gonna come back next year and do it again, and you're not discouraged. And I think that shows a lot of good character, I think.
Well, actually, one of the guys that organizes the competition, he works for a company called Sweet and Chili, and they actually put on the national finals for the Diageo World Class Canada, but they actually organize the global finals. And his name is John Gakuru. He worked at the Lab Cocktail Bar in London, like in the early 2000s, which is one of the world's first like craft cocktail bars. So he's there at the beginning of the scene, and he has this great saying that comes from Nelson Mandela. He's from Kenya, and so Nelson Mandela, big figure for him. But the phrase is, "I never lose; I either win or learn."
Yeah,
and so that was really, really awesome. Like I was in the room after hearing who was moving on to the Final Four, and I wasn't one of them, of course. And as much as you're stoked for the people that move on, you are pretty disappointed. And he kind of pulled me over and gave me that phrase, and I was like, man, that is super intense. And like. Yeah. Really, like,
especially
the best way to look at it, right? I mean, you know, taking things as defeats it's just not really productive, right? So, you know, you have to learn what you can and then apply that for next year. And so I'm really excited to come back with about a year until, you know, national finals next year to come back even more prepared. So I'm really excited to really like hit the ground like now. Yeah. Like, and I'm going to be working with Chris through his preparation for the world finals. So I'll get a pretty sweet insight onto.
And you've got two buddies here with a podcast who are more than willing to sit down and try your drinks.
I was going
to
say, you now have the track and food bump. So
The track.
This could be a thing.
This could be a thing. Okay. So before I do anything next year, definitely we'll run another podcast.
Absolutely. We'll give you that nice little
bump. The horseshoe up your butt, you know?
Saw on Scout this past Friday that they posted their latest kind of rankings talking about Vancouver's brunch scene.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if you, I think I shared it with you, Mick.
I didn't have a chance to have a look at it, so but run me through it.
I'm curious about this because there's some really good spots on there. There's like Wildebeest and Cafe Medina, Oakwood, Yolks. I believe there's Mammy Taylor's. I think there's a couple other places. Sean, are you a brunch guy? I'm curious about this one.
I love breakfast.
Okay.
I love brunch. I'm a big egg fan. Like, you know, if you ever at the Pac Rim and you want to talk to Mike Shum about brunch, don't bother. He hates breakfast. But I love breakfast and eggs and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah. I'm just hearing the restaurants you mentioned. I've been to, we're looking at
Shambar,
Oakwood.
Bells and Whistles.
I haven't had a chance to visit Bells and Whistles. Josh Papers have pretty good buddy. I worked with him at Supermarine for a year, and I'm definitely overdue to come check that out. Mammy Taylor's, obviously,
Little place. Have you heard of that place, Mammy Taylor's?
Jamie, have you heard of that place?
Hey, what's up, Ron? Shout out, Ron.
So, no, the reason why I'm asking about this is I just want to kind of get a sense, because I, having worked in the industry for so long, I have worked in places where brunch was a thing, and serving brunch can be not the funnest experience, but I'm kind of more on the vein of Mike Shum. I'm not really a brunch guy. I'm not really an egg guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's not really my thing. I don't really wake up on the weekends and go, ooh, I can't wait to go for brunch. But I wanted to kind of see if you guys felt, because this is obviously a thing. I mean, I'm definitely a minority here.
Yeah.
Most people love getting up and going for brunch. But I will say I love lunch. I like going and having 3-4 glasses of wine and relaxing for a couple hours. Like my favorite place for that for lunch is Au Comptoir. I love that place.
Oh, where's that?
That's
Kitsilano.
Yeah, it's in Kitsilano.
It's rad.
It's not far from you, actually.
Is this the Italian place that we're talking
about? No, this is the French place that's right across from Whole Foods.
Super French. It's like being transported into France.
Yeah,
this might be all the service staff are French. Yeah, they're amazing. The two guys that own it are just rad guys. Yeah.
Go there for brunch or lunch. It's on a Saturday or whatever. But like, it's not really my thing. But if I do go, I love going there.
But you don't like eggs. Is that your thing?
Yeah, I'm not an egg guy.
You're not an egg guy?
No.
No accounting for taste, I suppose.
When I go for brunch, if I'm gonna get a brunch dish, I'm more of a hash guy.
Love hash.
So I like a hash.
Love hash.
Like or waffles. I'll do waffles.
Waffles? Yeah. Like chicken and waffles or like sweet waffles?
Sweet waffles.
I like chicken waffles.
Sweet, syrupy.
Yolks has bomb.
Yolks is on
there. Yolks is on there. Yeah. Chicken and waffles. Yeah. They do.
I don't like Yolks. I went to their old crappy location and I didn't.
Whoa!
Didn't
it like says it. Character, Jamie.
Huh? No, it's character my ass. It was a shithole.
Is that
but
the?
But they're new.
Is this in the ceiling?
The brave bull.
No, but their new location is fine. I like it. They're like the new location. Okay, like it's brand new building. It's totally cool. But I did not like the old bit. Like I wasn't. It wasn't
don't be really so elitist, Jamie.
Well, I will tell you guys what I fucking hate brunch.
Explain to me what you hate about it.
Well, first of all, I'm vegan, so that's one thing.
That is one thing.
Second of all,
eggs are a crime.
I did work a job. Well,
that's your problem.
Chicken abortions.
Chicken abortions.
But I did work a job where I had to do brunch service, and the brunch people are so picky with these, you know, soft eggs, medium eggs, over whatever. It's just a whole thing, man.
You know, a soft poached egg is the thing of beauty, and if you get it hard poached and like your egg isn't runny, like I schlep all the way to this brunch place. I really hope that I don't have to wait in line because I'm not one of those like wait in line kind of brunchers.
Okay, good.
But like some people, yeah.
Like
some,
have you seen Jam Jar or whatever it is, the Jam Cafe?
Oh, it's nuts.
It's unbeatable. Like I see that and it's like a line just, for like 2 hours. I'm like, what is wrong with you?
Who the fuck lines up for plus like over, like, I would wait for a restaurant or for brunch or whatever. I would wait like 20 minutes tops.
Max, yeah. Maybe I've been exposed to like the wrong
maybe, brunch but like experiences. Let me get back to my point, which is that like let's say – I wouldn't have done this, but let's say you waited in line for 2 hours and all that you're looking for is just taking that like nicely buttered rye toast and just plunging it into that yolk inside this soft poached egg and just eating that like gooey, drippy yolk that's all over your buttery bread.
I don't get it.
Uh-huh.
And you know, stab that that egg with your toast triangle and you're cutting into hard boil. Like, fuck that. You guys blew it. You know, I'm paying $22 for fucking eggs and you can't even soft poach this thing?
I don't
know. That makes sense. I mean, it's the same if you got a steak and it was.
But here's the thing.
Yeah, I don't know. If you got a steak and you're like, I want that thing, like, I want it's like still like bleeding and you show up and it's like cardboard.
I've had numerous people tell me tons of times over that brunch is like the greatest thing ever. And I'm like, no, it's a meal that you go out for that's cost you $12. You talk like dinner should be the meal that you are like talking about like with the most hysteria because that's where you're gonna go spend a $200. Breakfast is fucking eggs and toast and bacon. Like really? Like you want to tell me that was the greatest thing in the world for $12?
No, man.
The reason why it's the greatest thing in the world is because you're hungry and you just woke up and you haven't had your coffee.
But if you had a night out, you know, you had Saturday night out, you know, Sunday is obviously the traditional brunch day. You know, these people that you are talking about that you, you know, have like.
Just the whole thing in general.
Yeah, and that's
the
what vibe. That's what I'm trying to get at.
The whole like, frenziness of
okay.
it. Like the whole like
the frenziness.
It's okay to be like happy to go for breakfast, but I'm just like the way people make it seem, they make it seem like it's this greatest thing in the world where it's like usually waiting in line for a super long time. The service sucks because most of the staff
they make
are
it
either,
seem like
I don't know. There's definitely like there's a bit there's like an Instagrammy like culty like
that's
oh my god
kinda,
I,
yeah
like I'm Trump, an influencer Trump and Tower. I went to Jam Cafe and I like selfied with my eggs for like
hey do you remember, I feel the same minutes. Way about afternoon tea, trust me.
Oh yeah, bro. I'm with you on afternoon tea.
And you're a tea
perfect.
Guy.
Who the fuck spends $100 on tea?
They don't
tea?
Drink fucking tea at afternoon tea.
Really?
They drink fucking English breakfast. It's not fucking tea. It's like a bastardized version black tea, and they put cream and sugar into it, and they're blends, and it's not actual real tea. It's not Chinese tea or like Taiwanese tea or tea for Sri Lanka. It's all blended and bastardized with sugar
like
and cream.
He's a tea sommelier, by the way.
He's a tea sommelier? Are you?
Well, tea sommelier in training.
Oh, wow. That's cool, man.
Fun fact.
If I ever need some like tea hookups for upcoming cocktail
actually, for Grant's winning cocktail for the Western Finals, I consulted him with – he did the cognac one? We worked
2014. It was a minute ago. But yeah, that's rad. Yeah. Tea. Okay, dope.
Think of me.
I'm coming to you for some – think of
so
you.
Think
of me for some tea.
And I'll come to you for rum and anything else cocktail-wise.
Sure.
What's wrong with just peanut butter toast?
That's basic as shit. I don't know. It's just like it's
but
so,
it's so good,
Jamie. Like
not every day of your life,
it's,
though.
It's peanut butter and toast. That's like what you make when you have an empty fridge. It's not food.
It's great food. I think it's delicious.
Yeah, okay, well, fruit. I my breakfast every day is the same thing. It's a pot of tea and one orange. That's and maybe a Lara bar.
That
maybe.
Sounds like super healthy, and
it sounds like you're really hungry.
Yeah, well, I eat a big lunch.
Yeah.
Big lunch.
Yeah. This is how messed up my brain is. Yesterday I was thinking during Mother's Day that I was like, if I was like a billionaire like Bill Gates, I would love to go to all the brunch places here in Vancouver and give each one of them and say, here's $100,000. Don't open today.
$100,000 is a bit steep. You could give them $10,000.
Here's $100,000. Don't open today. And then all the people that don't want to go for a brunch, fuck you. Stay home.
All right. Well, I think for me, the best thing about brunch is day drinking, which I'm all for.
See, that's what I like about brunch. Yeah. I like the day drinking. And I'm not going to say I hate brunch. I don't fully hate it. I actually had a really good brunch experience at Wildebeest for...
Recently?
It was about 6 months ago. Okay. And it was fantastic. I was pleasantly surprised. The service was fantastic. Mm-hmm. We were a big group. Food was really good. That's probably because we were all drinking a lot too, which probably made it way more experience.
Brunch involves cocktails.
Yeah. Brunch involves cocktails. Yeah. I'm into that. I like that. It's great. Yeah. It might be changing my mind about brunch. I don't know.
Anyways, we got to wrap up. Sean McWiggan, thank you for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, guys.
We wish you the best on your future competitions. I also published an article on Track and Food recently. Last week, I talked about some articles that were written in Van Meg, and I kind of pulled those two articles into an idea about dining and Vancouver's kind of restaurant soul. So do look for that. It's on Medium under Track and Food. And also, you can find us on iTunes and Stitcher. And please subscribe. Please rate us. And thank you for listening, and we will see you soon.